This podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity, like Progressive Home and Auto Policies. They're best when bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and here's my question. I'm white, and I've often heard the critique that white people's attempts at anti-racism and or social justice work are largely performative. I definitely do not want to be performative, but as somebody who is still learning how to show up for anti-racism, what's the alternative?
Welcome to How To. I'm Courtney Martin. We love when you guys send us hard questions, like the one you just heard. Ultimately, Michelle wasn't up for coming on the show, which we totally understand, but her question has really resonated with me. Maybe it's resonating with you too, given what's been happening this year all across the country.
Universities here in Texas are now banned from engaging in any diversity, equity, and inclusion activities.
Governor Cox vowed to end diversity hiring practices at Utah's public colleges and universities.
The State Board of Education passed a rule permanently prohibiting diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the Florida college system.
I don't know about you, but stories like these make me want to take action. When fighting for racial justice, there's a phrase that is often floated these days. Maybe you've heard it. It's, quote, doing the work. But sometimes you wonder, what does that actually mean? I mean, as I see it, doing the work is largely about getting willing white folks to listen to, learn from, and fight alongside people of color, which is essential. It's something we talked a lot about after the death of George Floyd in 2020. It was such a sobering, important moment for so many people. But these days, the backlash is real. As we just heard, racial justice work is getting harder in some states, which is all the more reason that we need to welcome people into the racial justice conversation rather than alienating them further. Now, getting back to Michelle's voicemail, how can white people engage in that conversation and take action in ways that aren't performative, that are meaningful, that actually help the communities they want to help? Today, we're going to talk about it with two amazing guests. First up is Garrett Bucks.
I train folks through a group called the Barn Raisers Project, which focuses on helping white people who don't think of themselves as activists or organizers learn how to organize for racial justice in majority white communities.
This kind of work can take many different forms. It might be folks in Minneapolis thinking about how to help their neighbors understand why it's important to use indigenous names for the local lakes, or folks in Chicago showing up at city council meetings to fight for affordable housing so longtime residents of color don't get pushed out of their neighborhoods. Importantly, these white folks aren't leading these efforts, but they're responding to what local leaders of color are saying would be genuinely supportive. For Garrett, that kind of responsiveness wasn't always second nature.
I spent a career literally doing a lot of the things that a lot of white do-gooders do. I thought, well, if I want to make a difference in the world, that difference is to be made in other people's communities, majority Black and brown communities, that A, I have a right to all those communities, be that as a teacher, be that as a nonprofit executive, et cetera, that like I should just go there and that's where the work is, right? And not just that that's where the work is, that's work that could benefit from me in one way or another.
Garrett fell into the familiar narrative of the white savior, a do-gooder who wants to change the world and instead kind of makes a mess of things.
I was doing all these big fancy title nonprofit jobs, but I was also really trying to showcase how much better I was and how much more I knew about social justice in general, but in particular about anti-racism than other white people.
Garrett was, as he understands it now, more invested in proving to himself and others that he was an ally than actually doing the long-term, local, community-rooted work of being one.
Perhaps if I run away from other white people and prove that I'm not like them, maybe I'll get to a different place myself. I don't think that running away really helped much, but it also, I don't think if I said I cared about social change and making the world a better place, I don't think I was being very useful.
He came to realize that running away from other white people meant he was fighting for racial justice with one hand tied behind his back, as he puts it. So that's why he started the Barn Raisers Project.
Last few years, I've been experimenting with what happens if I turn my attention towards building deeper relationships with other white people, in particular, other white people who do crave a different world. And what does it look like to help each other, not save each other, but help each other figure that out?
Garrett is getting at this really interesting truth here. Despite all the post-George Floyd book buying and bias training, a lot of white people, we just aren't sure how to actually engage in racial justice, especially locally and meaningfully. Garrett recently wrote something about this that I thought was really poignant. He wrote, "If we're all trying to outrun our whiteness, myself, the white liberals who read the right books, but recoil at calls to house the homeless or defund the police, the Trump voters who say that wokeness has gone too far, then we're actually all in a similar boat." And organizing always starts from a discovery of shared struggle. White people in America who genuinely want to be part of fighting racism are too often spending energy fighting one another. As Garrett has written, we need to start the conversation at a more fundamental level, one that goes to kind of the core of our own identity. Like, white people, what do we fear about a less racist society? What do we dream about? How our own lives could be different in beautiful, life-giving ways? What would it take to actually build that together?
Here's what I still don't know how to do about this. Here's what I haven't figured out. Here's the piece of privilege and power that I'm afraid to give up, that I'm afraid to do something different on. That muscle of more and more spaces of that with other white people, even if we don't know the outcome of that conversation, is just so valuable because we haven't done any of that.
And that brings us to our second guest.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Doerr. I am a writer and organizer in Portland, Oregon, and I write about climate change, climate justice, and anti-racism.
Like me, Elizabeth has participated in Garrett's Barn Raisers training, and she's going to share a recent story from her life that will function as a bit of a case study. It has to do with something a lot of us can relate to, her kids' experience at a public school. Now, I know this can be kind of a touchy subject, but these problems we're talking about are among society's biggest, and they're the ones that most desperately need answers. So, thanks for sticking with us. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? Or what is the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. In a lot of ways, Elizabeth had a pretty similar do-gooder trajectory to Garrett. She joined the Peace Corps, she got a degree in international education policy, she became a bit of a woke know-it-all.
My job in higher ed was actually training college students on social justice curriculum. And so even through that process, I I felt like I needed to know everything and to be kind of have reached the pinnacle of social justice. And then, you know, I started to really realize what I was not seeing and that how much I didn't understand and how much I was participating in, or I guess being complicit in the systemic racism by kind of just containing it to my work world and not really doing that in my personal life and thinking about my personal life. But I also know that I don't know everything. And I think that that's been really helpful for me to just be a lot more open about that as far as my anti-racism journey goes.
While Elizabeth has done a ton of personal work, she's still wondering how to navigate conversations about racism with other white people. Recently, a fellow white family, a family she thought she shared values and a commitment to integration with, decided to pull their first grader from their public school and go private.
They made the decision abruptly, and my son was like, hey, you know, so-and-so is at a different school now. And I was like, what? And so that's when I texted the parents just to be like, is this true? And my son has mentioned that there are a couple of kids that can be kind of disruptive, but it doesn't really bother him that much. And the other parent had mentioned that it really bothers her son. And I gather that the ones that are disruptive are not white. And so this could have been a good opportunity to have a conversation about ways kids have learned how to regulate their emotions and, you know, different backgrounds, and rather than kind of taking them out of the environment.
Garrett, I want to workshop this with you. And I'm thinking, like, the version of this that is really unenlightened is like, you know, and this is, you know, me talking straight out of like the id of my anti-racist white identity is like, okay, snowflakey white kid who's like, parents think he's going to break apart if he's around anyone who's like messing up his day, gets pulled out of the school. Parents are, because of racial bias, thinking that, of course, these kids of color are like disruptive and sort of making their disruption into something larger than it is, kind of making it of freakish proportions because they are like acting on racist bias. Like, this family is what's wrong with white parents. Like, that's like the asshole version, right? Which is in me, because I obviously could have just articulated it so quickly. Garrett, what are you hearing in these spectrums? And is there an even less asshole version that Elizabeth and I could learn from?
Well, do you mind if I if this is okay, Courtney, I'd love to ask Elizabeth to go more asshole for me right now. Like, what did you really want to say?
I mean, really what I want to say, what's in the back of my mind is that this seems like a racist decision.
Tell me about what your fears are if that was not expressed to that parent.
You know, it's hard because I don't know. I feel like it's less about that one person and more about kind of the fear that others will follow. Because when one person makes a decision, you know, it kind of, oh, someone's like, oh, they're making this decision because, you know, they don't think this school is good for their kid. Maybe the school isn't good for mine. And so I feel like it creates this kind of snowball effect.
More and more white parents opting out of even the attempt at integration, an attempt at pluralism, and an attempt at not just saying, I want mine and I want to push my kid to the front of the
yeah,
pile.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I want to stop us for a second to break down what Garrett is doing. He's tapping into Elizabeth's gut reaction, the stuff, you know, underneath the niceties and all the fancy language, to get at her core motivations and even fears. Too often, progressive white folks think we're holding some kind of moral line when there's actually something else going on. We're policing others, trapped in some comforting delusion of superiority, or, you know, we're refusing to admit that we're hurt and scared.
Tell me more about your relationship with them. Like, how deep it is, how much you know about their kid, about their hopes and dreams and fears, about their values, etc.
Well, I've known them since before our kids started kindergarten. We have a mutual friend and they're like, oh, your kids are going to the same school. And we've sort of developed a friendship that borderline's acquaintances. Like, there have been attempts to get to know them a little bit better. And the mom has, I organize our local meetings around integrated schools. And so the mom has attended them. So I know that, like, the conversations have been in their heads. And so values-wise, I think we're pretty on the same plane. But I'll say this, like, this is kind of an indictment on Portland in general, because on the surface, it's liberal, but really you get deeper and deeper, and people, the decisions that people make for them, for their community, for their neighborhoods, become a lot more conservative.
Would it be an appropriate summary to say, like, yeah, first off, there is a relationship here. There's some things I know about them and about their commitment to equity and awareness. Some things I don't know. I have some hypotheses about potentially, you know, the mom and dad being in different places here. But I hear their hypotheses. There's a lot that you don't know about this family, too. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, 100%. Yes. Totally. Wow, what totally. A good synopsis for something that took me a million years to get to.
No. That's the fun of getting to be the listener, right? So I want to, like, talk about a couple layers at once. The first is the layer of the false dichotomy that we often put ourselves in when we think about real talk conversations. And then I want to talk about what the conversation between white people about rethinking whiteness and our relationship to it is really about. So I want to play those two different levels. The first level, it's interesting that, you know, you asked the question of, like, essentially, like, how do I not be a judgmental jerk to other white people, right? And what Courtney and I have kind of discovered, and we've discovered all together, the three of us, right, like, is, like, actually, you didn't say the thing you were worried was the jerkish thing. It sounds like potentially your worry is that actually, you know, I kind of toned it down so that I may have still come off as a self-righteous jerk, but I also didn't actually say the thing I believed in, right? Is that kind of accurate?
Yeah, I think that there's an that's, I think, where I've kind of at, is, like, there's an overcorrection in knowing that I could easily say something that goes too past, and then I overcorrect, but either not saying something or... Yeah, and not really knowing even when the appropriate place was, because, you know, they didn't ask. But also at the same time, it feels like, you know, it would be worth saying something.
Totally. Totally.
There is a point when you get to be too direct or too harsh that creates that cognitive dissonance where they just shut down and kind of could go the other way. And, like, what we really want is for them to hear it and to think about it and potentially, you know, make changes or whatever, but at least have that in their mind for whenever the next scenario happens.
You're naming exactly the right desire here, right? And I think the dichotomy we often get ourselves into, and I don't think this is just unique to white communities, but I think it's particularly present in white communities because I think that it speaks to an individualistic culture, it speaks to not fully understanding what community and relationship actually is. The thinking is relationships are nice. Relationships are ones that we don't talk about the real stuff, potentially, or that we're only affirming each other. When in fact, like, if we think about the depth of relationships that we value the most, right, in our lives, and when we say the word community, the community that matters the most, right, like, we probably are picturing in our mind relationships that have both loved us, but also pushed us. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I want to say is that it takes two to tango with a relationship and a conversation. Mm-hmm. So for me, the first step is always an invitation. And I want to make sure that the invitation is as open and honest as possible. So I give the person a choice to say, like, let's go find, first off, I want it to be not reactive, not like just from the text or from the moment, stuff like that. I'm like, let's find a time and place together to talk about this that they can choose to take you up on or not choose to take you up on. And I don't want them saying yes unless they know the following. The first is that I have an opinion on this matter. And I actually have a strong opinion on this matter. And you, in this case, that I am really, really scared about the decisions that a lot of white parents in Portland are making to opt out of spaces that they share with Black and brown kids. And I am really, really scared, not just for the societal implications of that, but I also believe that there's racism behind this choice. So I want them to know that that opinion is on the table, A. But B, there's probably a lot I don't know about them, their story, what they're struggling with, why this is a hard decision, etc. And I want to have a conversation where both of those things are allowed to be there. Not to get to a middle ground where I say, okay, this is the 50% of racism you're allowed to do, but where this person who knows that I have a very strong opinion still has time for them, still has time to stick with them. Even if at the end of the first conversation, we're still in disagreement, if at the end of the second conversation, we're still in disagreement, that what keeps coming through is like, yes, I'm firm in a place, but I also recognize the things you're wrestling with feel different to you, feel hard for you, etc.
So you're approaching the conversation by planning a time where both people can show up ready to talk, laying out what you're thinking and feeling with plain spoken courage, but also being clear that you're more invested in growing together than legislating who is right.
One of the things that make us feel ill-equipped as white people to have conversations about white supremacy or racism is that we think about these conversations as just conversations about, okay, if they only have the knowledge, or if they only have the ideology, or only have the belief system. You know, as you just mentioned, like, there's probably tons of bookshelves across the city of Portland with all the right anti-racist books on them, but tons of decisions that people are still making about their home, about their kids, about their jobs, etc., that reinforce systems of domination, right? And so it's not about the beliefs, not about the ideology. It is about that, you know, any system of domination that you get to be on top of, you know, white supremacy for white people, patriarchy for men, capitalism for people who are income secure, etc., that's actually a change process, right? That's not just a belief process. That's about giving something up. That's about stepping into the unknown. That's about trying something new. We should be called to do that. We should not be babied and said, oh, that's hard, so we don't have to do that, or we can opt out. We should be welcomed into that conversation. But we should also recognize that that conversation, if it's going to be useful, is not just about, here's what I believe, here's what you believe. That conversation, if it's going to be useful, is going to be about, I really want to know why this is a hard decision for you, because I hope you don't make it. I hope you stick with this class. But I want to know why that change feels hard for you, where that comes from for you, where that comes from for your partner. You're never just talking about the situation itself. And so there's just so much to get into. I really want to ask those questions about what about this feels so tricky for them, because that's fascinating to me. And I probably have a similar story myself about a hypocrisy I'm currently struggling with too, that may be an interesting part of this conversation.
Whether it's the proverbial racist uncle at the Thanksgiving table or the progressive neighbor you thought you shared protests and values with, you can't go into a conversation with the sole intention of changing their minds. It will put them on the defensive, and frankly, it's totally unrealistic. Instead, lean into the relationship. Seek to understand their fears. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to keep digging into what's underneath that all-too-common pitfall of white progressivism, righteousness.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
We're back with Elizabeth Dorr, who wants advice on how to talk to a fellow white family who pulled their kid from an integrating public school, and Garrett Bucks, founder of the Barn Raisers Project and author of the new book, The Right Kind of White. I should add here for context, I have also written about this topic. I published a book a couple years ago called Learning in Public that takes readers through my own family's journey of deciding to enroll our daughters in a Black majority Title I public school and show up joyfully and humbly. I think part of why it's hard to be curious in a moment like that, and I wonder how you relate to this, Elizabeth, is in order to make countercultural decisions, like sending your kid to the school that other people think is a little scary and, you know, you're a little bit radical for doing that, and are you sure that's a safe choice for your kid? Like, in order to do that, I think you often have to sort of tell yourself a very clear story about why it is okay, why your kid is safe, why, you know, it's just a very like black and white binary story that you tell yourself so that you can make that what is a hard decision socially, right? Yeah. We know we could have a whole thing about how our kids are not actually at much risk, but like socially, it is a risk to do something that your quote unquote tribe isn't doing, right? So we tell ourselves a really strong story. Then when someone like this family says, actually, this isn't safe or this isn't okay, I think you are genuinely worried about the snowball effect, which is very real. And we've seen a lot of, you know, families that do sort of catch this contagious disease of thinking like, oh, the school actually isn't okay and we're all going to leave. But also, is there something underneath? And I guess I'm asking this because I'm telling you this is true for me, that it's hard to open up to some of the challenges. Like, in order to survive the experience, I need to tell myself everything's 100% fine. It's hard to let in, like, oh, have I not been paying attention to my kid? And maybe, like, they are 25% not okay. And if I actually listen to this person, I'm gonna have to take in the ways in which the classroom is, like, feeling maybe a little bit unsafe for some of the kids. And what does that mean about my own kids and race? You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely.
It forces you to tell a more nuanced story that you might not really feel comfortable telling.
That is something that we've talked about, is that like, do I want to even be thinking about what might be wrong? Yeah.
You know, I've had the exact same experience of friends leaving, you know, my kid's school and trying to figure out how to have these conversations. And I loved Garrett's question about fear, because it reminded me of the best conversation I've had with a friend who pulled her kid from our school, was very vulnerable. We both, like, we really made time for it, and we knew it was going to be hard, and we knew we were going to have to bump up against some stuff we disagreed about. But one of the things that came up for me that I was like embarrassed about, but knew operates under some of these conversations, was that I was afraid she was going to go to other people in our, you know, larger community and talk about that this school wasn't a safe place, and that I felt really protective of our school and really defensive about that snowball effect. And so I was able to say to her, like, I know you're making this choice. Is there anything from you need from me around this? And what I would love from you, if you can give it to me, is that you talk about the beautiful aspects of this school that you've left, and like keep holding those up for people, because that would, it would feel really good to me, just in the level of like, I love this community and I want people to know it's beautiful. And the political aspects of that snowball effect would be lessened if more people who leave the school didn't have a black and white way of talking about it. So it was cool because we were both able to like say what we needed and maintain our relationship to the point of relationships, Garrett. So just wondering if that's helpful to you to hear that.
Yeah, I love that. And like, I actually was just recalling a conversation that, I mean, this was like years ago, but one of my son's classmates from preschool they had left like sometime during the pandemic, and they were in soccer together, and the kid's grandparent was like, started to talk shit about the preschool. And I was like, got super like defensive, because it was like, well, I'm choosing to keep my kid there.
That moment for Elizabeth created a bit of a binary, where she felt like she was the good white person for sticking at the school as planned, and her friends were the bad white people for deserting. Now, it's obviously more complex than that, but where is the place to draw a bright moral line?
There are truths about the world that are really, really important to align ourselves to as kind of moral North Stars, right? And I think the difference, if I can go back a little bit, right, isn't necessarily about the stridency of like some of our moral lines. I think that's potentially really, really great. It is about how we're relating to the people that we are trying to both influence and potentially being open to be influenced by. I loved what you were saying, Courtney, earlier about like these conversations that you've had and how they have been both about the other person's fears and your fears, right? And when I was listening to Elizabeth, it seems that like the line that you're actually hoping to walk here is not a line about level of stridency. It's not a line about like how firmly you believe something or even how vociferously you name that. It's about whether the relationships you're having with other white families in your school, in Portland, and in Oregon, if your goal in that those relationships is to move the white savior lens that folks like us may have previously applied overly to our relationship to communities of color over to white people and be like, it's my job to save them from the mistake they're going to make. It's my job to stop them from these white supremacy mistakes. To you're trying to welcome more and more people into a mess with you.
Yeah.
Right? Be like, can you at least stay in that conversation with me? And here's what's coming up for me as I'm in that conversation. Here's what I do feel really firm with. Here's what I don't feel really firm on. How about for you? And can we keep on holding each other as we walk forward?
And you're also making me think there's two parts of what's happening in the relationship. One is, what is the choice that a white person is making that you see as racist? If, you know, if it's Elizabeth or me or Garrett talking to someone. And what is the meaning that that person and you are making of the choice? So it's like you can, a person can make a choice that you wish they didn't feel like they had to make, mm-hmm. right? And you could say, like, have serenity around that. It's like, I wish you didn't feel like you had to make this choice, but I honor that you do feel this way. The second is what meaning the person makes of that choice and what meaning you make of that choice. And that's where it feels like what you're saying, Garrett, is so important about the messiness and the ongoing relational aspect of it is like maybe they make a choice that actually does make a school have less resources and, you know, feel a little more chaotic because there are people coming in and out and that's like hard on the school. But maybe the meaning they make about the choice they made feeds some other like aspect of making the city more just or the community more just in the long run, because they don't tell a particular story about why they had to leave the school that like compounds the racism.
Yeah. Because we're going to be effing up all the time and we eff up all the time because we're new babies at this. And I would like, I took that those failures so hard early on, but I think what has changed, and I think as you kind of have more practice with it, like building that muscle, is that it doesn't deeply hurt me anymore. You know, I think that it's like the, you know, the white woman's tears is kind of where that comes from, because it is really hard to hear something when you're failing. But then like I started to be like, it's not me personally, it is. I mean, I'm doing this, but it's because I've been conditioned as a part of the systemic racism. And so for me, I've been able to like detach myself, like me personally as a human being with the values that I have, from the societal part of it and be like, I am doing this because I'm conditioned to do it. But now I recognize that I can kind of course correct. I'm still going to fail every once in a while, but I can do it differently this time. And so it's kind of like I'm able to like take it in and then move on. But like not everybody is at that place with it. So I think that that's where it's having these conversations. Yeah. That's where it starts. Yeah. That's where it starts, is actually talking about race in a matter of fact way.
That's it. Yeah.
But also in a long term relational investment way, right? That's what I'm taking away from this conversation is like, because I can get caught up like you, Elizabeth, and thinking like, well, I didn't say the real truth in that particular interaction. And then I'm like, Courtney, if this is going to be an effective relationship, I mean, if it's going to be a loving relationship, if it's going to be an effective, like, portal for social change, it's going to be a long haul relationship.
You'll have another opportunity.
Hopefully be 1,000 more conversations. Yeah, and maybe next time you'll actually say it, right?
And that's it.
Garrett, you know I'm not going to let you get away without telling us about the religion of being right versus the religion of being in love.
Hey, you know, this piece of wisdom given to me by my childhood pastor that I thought I was listening to and learning from back in the day, but that I actually was doing the opposite of for much of my life, because that's what happens with wisdom. We find ways to justify not listening to it. And he uses the term religion, and it came to me from my pastor, but he didn't mean it just in like religion, like the theological sense. He meant religion as a belief system, that there are two religions in the world, the religion of being right and the religion of being in love. And the only rule is you can't be a member of both at the same time. And I spent a long time caring about the religion of being right. And what you all just talked about, just right there, right? Like, oh my God, I've messed up. If I have not like fully solved racism with this other white person in this single conversation, right? That is the religion of being right. The problem is not that the strident to your belief. You can be strident about your belief. It is the idea that the only value this other person has in me is for me to correct them, to solve for them, to save them, etc. The religion of being love has the same strength of belief, the same strength, the same, you know, moral North Star. But the difference is that you are guided instead of by your ability to fix, solve, win, and dominate conversations and relationships, that you are guided by a sense of the real profound gift of getting to be in relationship. And that is both relationships with the world, relationships with communities, both ones that you know and don't, relationships with ones that you have, that you are placed in inequitable systems in relation to, but also in these direct relationships. And the trick, I think, to not falling into the pattern of just taking your white saviorism and moving it from I'm trying to save communities of color to I'm trying to save other white people, is that you still have these strident conversations. You still have these conversations in which it's very clear where you're coming from and where your values are. But your hope for them is not, oh my God, I need to save this other white person from their wrong belief. Your hope for them is, I want to build this relationship stronger and stronger because I'm still figuring it out too. And I would want and hope for this person to be someone by my side who is pushing themselves, but who's also pushing me and who can be honest with me about where they're still messing up, but who I can be equally honest, and where hopefully we can get this relationship to a point where we can be useful to each other in that way, and we can be welcoming more and more people in. And that distinction, for me, really makes all the difference.
I love that.
Once more, Garrett's book is called The Right Kind of White. And if you want to take things further than where we got today, you can learn to organize through the Barn Raisers Project. We'll put a link in the show notes. Do you have a mirror you need help looking into? Send us a note at howto@slate.com or leave us a voicemail at 646-495-4001. And we might have you on the show. And if you like what you heard today, please give us a rating and a review and tell a friend. That helps us help more people. How To is produced by Rosemary Belson with Kevin Bendis. Joel Meyer is senior editor and Derek John is executive producer. Merritt Jacob is senior technical director and composed our theme music. Charles Duhigg created the show. Carvel Wallace is my co-host. I'm Courtney Martin. Thanks for listening.